Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear
that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States.
Taking office in January 1953, President Eisenhower could look nostalgically back a century and a half to a simpler time, to the presidency of John Adams.
Sometimes, as I stand outside the White House, I look at it, and I note that the first president that occupied it had his entire office, all his office force, and his living quarters all within the main part of the building. Succeeding presidents have built on wings. We have now gone across and taken over one building that used to house three great departments of government, and we still don't have room for the president's office and the separate offices that are attached to him. This is indicative of what has happened to us in the United States, in the complexities of our economy and industries, and in government and its complexities. And while this has all happened, that government and our daily lives have likewise become intertwined.
All presidents have felt a basic need to address themselves to the nation as a whole. President Roosevelt made extensive use of radio, particularly with his fireside chats. But by 1953, increasing numbers of American families owned television sets, and President Eisenhower made the decision to televise his press conferences, thus reaching out to the American people directly and dramatically.
The presidency is not merely an institution. The president is also a personality. They are interested in his thinking. They believe that the president should be able to speak to the whole country in some way. I believe they want to see is the president probably capable of going through the whole range of subjects that can be fired at him and giving to the average citizen some concept of what he's thinking about the whole works.
Later, when President Eisenhower made his decision to run for a second term, he echoed Presidents Roosevelt and Truman as he spoke of the increasing responsibilities and burdens of the presidential office.
Of course, the duties of the president are essentially endless. No daily schedule of appointments can give a full timetable or even a faint indication of the president's responsibilities. Entirely aside from the making of important decisions, the formulation of policy through the National Security Council and the cabinet, cooperation with the Congress and with the state, there is for the president a continuous burden of study, contemplation, and reflection. These are a particular constitutional responsibility of the president. All these matters, among others, are with the president always. In Washington, in a summer White House, on a weekend absence, indeed, even at a ceremonial, a dinner, and in every hour of leisure. The old saying is true, a president never escapes from his office.
The president is constitutionally charged with the duty of executing the law of the land, and the years of the Eisenhower administration were notable for a series of controversial and important Supreme Court decisions. But President Eisenhower felt that it was unwise for the chief executive personally to comment on the court decisions which underlay his actions.
I do not believe it is the function, or indeed it's a desirable for a president to express his approval or disapproval of any Supreme Court decision. His job for which he takes an oath is to execute the laws. Now, if he, in advance of such execution, says, I don't like it, but I will do it, and in the other case says, I do like it, I will do it, he's constantly laying the whole law enforcement processes of the federal government open to the suspicion that he is doing his duty one time well and the other time not well. I don't object to anyone else in the whole world disagreeing publicly with opinions or decisions of the courts or agreeing with them. I say, I've got a particular function, and I think it would make it more difficult to carry out that function if I indulged in that kind of, personal action with respect to court's decisions.
As President Eisenhower's two terms in office drew to a close, the campaign of 1960 came to occupy the center of the nation's attention. Addressing the American people, the president gave voice to the innermost feelings of one who, after his historic military feats in the Second World War, now for 8 years had held the highest office in the land.
Almost 16 and a half years ago, almost on the very eve of D-Day, I became absorbed in a soul-wracking problem. A senior staff officer of mine, an attested and gallant battle leader, came to me to express his conviction that part of the plan that I had devised and approved would require the destruction of two fine American divisions, two airborne divisions of gallant soldiers. If he were right, it appeared that the attack on Utah Beach was probably hopeless. And this meant that the whole operation suddenly acquired a degree of risk, even foolhardiness, that could generate a gigantic failure, possibly Allied defeat and defeat in Europe. And the decision was squarely up to me. There was no one could help me. Professional and technical advice and counsel had been exhausted. There was nothing for me to do but to go to my tent and think out this problem alone. Now, seriously, I reviewed every single step in my battle plan. And having completed that study, I phoned him and said the attack would go as ordered. Now, events proved, happily, his prediction to be wrong. But for years thereafter, I felt that for only once in a lifetime could a problem of that sort weigh so heavily upon a man's mind and heart. Now, my fellow Americans, now that I know that in this age, the president encounters soul-wracking problems many times in a single term of office, I really realize what we are asking the next president to do. This kind of problem comes to him in every conceivable form, almost every day that he's in office. The nakedness of the battlefield, when the soldier is all alone in the smoke and the clamor and the terror of war, is comparable to the loneliness, at times, of the presidency. These are the times when one man must conscientiously, deliberately, prayerfully scrutinize every argument, every proposal, every prediction, every alternative, every probable outcome of his action, and then, all alone, make his decision. Even his most trusted associates and friends cannot help him in that moment. He can draw only upon the truths and principles responsible for America's birth and development, applying them to the problem immediately before him in the light of a broad experience with men and nations. He will be face to face with himself, his conscience, his measure of wisdom, and he will have to pray for guidance from Almighty God.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear
that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will
John F. Kennedy took the oath of office as President of the United States on the 20th of January, 1961.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
John Kennedy came to the office of the president after 14 years in the United States Congress, years of public service that surely could be considered effective preparation for the highest office in the land. Yet once in office, Kennedy, like Eisenhower before him, found that no experiences can adequately prepare a man for the modern presidency.
It's a tremendous change to go from being a senator to being president. In the first months, it's very difficult. I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed in the United States are greater than I imagined them to be. And there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be. And I think that's probably true of anyone who becomes president, because there is such a difference between those who advise or speak or legislate and between the man who must select from the various alternatives proposed and say that this shall be the policy of the United States. Well, it's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments, because unfortunately your advisors are frequently divided. The president must finally choose. Well, that old story about Abraham Lincoln in the cabinet. He says, all in favor say aye, and the whole cabinet voted aye, and then all opposed no, and Lincoln voted no, and he said the vote is no. So naturally, the Constitution places the responsibility on the president. The other point is something that President Eisenhower said to me in January 19th. He said, there are no easy matters will ever come to you as president. If they're easy, they will be settled at a lower level. So the matters that finally come to you as president are always the difficult matters, and matters which carry with them large implications. So this contributes to some of the burdens of the office of the presidency, which other presidents have commented on.
Today, a great proportion of the business of the presidency must be handled by subordinates and by departments of the administration. This is sometimes cumbersome, and President Kennedy chafed at the delays and inefficiencies of modern government.
The president can't administer a department, but at least he can be a stimulant, because there's a great tendency in government to have papers stay on desks too long. And it seems to me that's one really of a function. You know, after I met Mr. Khrushchev in Vienna, and they gave us an aide memoir, took me out through the State Department, coordinate with the British, the French, and the Germans. It took much too long. So it seems to me that one of the functions of the president is try to have it move with more speed. Otherwise, you can wait while the world collapses.
During the Kennedy administration, the question of the legitimate extent of the functions of government was once again raised, particularly with reference to the social and economic affairs of our country. President Kennedy clearly felt that the government, most especially the president, must be held accountable for the state of the nation, and thus must act in almost any area of American life when conditions warranted such action.
In spite of the strong feeling on many that the federal government should mind its own business, whatever that may be, and stay out of businesses. The fact is that when things go bad, the chickens come to roost on the president's house. Mr. Herbert Hoover was, we know in legend, responsible for all the difficulties of 1929. President Truman bore responsibility for the 49 recession. President Eisenhower was blamed for the recessions in 54, 58, and 60. When the stock market had its difficulties last spring, I got a good many letters. I receive no mail thanking me and expressing admiration for my economic wisdom when the market goes up, but when it goes down, we all know who's wrong. Therefore, that being true, recognizing that the President of the United States and the government will be responsible if we have economic difficulties, it seems to me that we have some right to present proposals which may lessen those economic difficulties. And people do look to Washington in all kinds of ways when difficulty comes across the country.
At Christmas time, 1962, after nearly 2 years in the White House, John Kennedy, now fully aware of the awesome difficulties associated with his office, told of the satisfactions which also accompanied them.
The presidency, there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency because particularly if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if you and if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country for almost 20 years have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat and since then against the communist threat. Now I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. I think we ought to be rather pleased with ourselves this Christmas.
President Kennedy did not live to celebrate another Christmas. Assassination cut short his life. As president, he had only 1,000 days. Under circumstances of national sorrow, almost disbelief, Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson took the presidential oath of office late in the afternoon on November 22nd, 1963.
As I left the hospital and on the way to Air Force One, and while we were waiting for Judge Hughes and Ms. Kennedy to come aboard, I wasn't sure whether this was an international conspiracy, just what it was or what might happen next. I was sure that the whole nation had been shaken and the world would be in doubt. First priority was try to display to the world that we could have continuity and transition, demonstrate to the people of this country that although their leader had fallen and we had a new president, that we must have unity and we must close ranks and we must work together for the good of all America and the world.
Lyndon Johnson was the second vice president to succeed to the presidency in midterm in less than 20 years. Long a keen student of American public life, no man could have been more aware than was he of the responsibilities which the office brought with it.
FDR brought me into this house and this room when I was only 27. I was privileged to know very well and work very closely with President Truman and President Eisenhower, as well as the late beloved President Kennedy. I also count as a very special treasure my friendship with President Hoover in later years. Admiral Dewey could say back in 1900 that the office of the president is not such a difficult one to fill. I doubt that that was even true in 1900. I know it's not true today. This office is a difficult office, and any who occupy it must be an humble man before the task that he faces. This office is also a great institution of freedom. No man could be more aware than I of how the office towers above the man who occupies it and gives to him strength that's much greater than his own.
President Kennedy had said, let us begin. President Johnson said, let us continue.
One of the hardest tasks that a president faces is to keep the time scale of his decisions always in mind and to try to be the president of all the people. He's not simply responsible to an immediate electorate either. He has to try to see how his decisions will affect not only today's citizens, but their children and their children's children unto the third and the fourth generation. He has to try to peer into the future, and he has to prepare for that future. There are always critics around imploring the president to stick to the facts and not to go crystal gazing. And some of them tell me to try to keep my feet on the ground, if not my head in the sand. But this is the point. The facts include today the overwhelming, built-in, irresistible forces of change have been unleashed by modern science and technology. To make no predictions is to be sure to be wrong. The president of this country, more than any other single man in the world, must grapple with the course of events and the directions of history.
President Johnson served the remaining year of John Kennedy's term, and in the fall of 1964 was overwhelmingly elected president in his own right. He spoke to Congress and to the nation early in 1965. He spoke, in some ways, for all who have held the office of the President of the United States.
The president's hardest task is not to do what is right, but to know what is right. Yet the presidency brings no special gift of prophecy or foresight. You take an oath, you step into an office, and you must then help guide a great democracy. The answer was waiting for me in the land where I was born. It was once barren land. But men came and they worked and they endured and they built. Why did men come to that once forbidding land? Well, they were restless, of course. And they had to be moving on. But there was more than that. There was a dream. A dream of a place where a free man could build for himself and raise his children to a better life. A dream of a continent to be conquered, a world to be won, a nation to be made. Remembering this, I knew the answer. A president does not shape a new and personal vision of America. He collects it from the scattered hopes of the American past. It has guided us every step of the way. It sustains every president. It shall lead us as we enter the third century of the search for a more perfect union.